The Los Angeles-based Calder Quartet performs a broad range of repertory at an exceptional level, always striving to channel the true intention of the work's creator. The group's distinctive approach is exemplified by a musical curiosity brought to everything it plays, whether Beethoven, Mozart, Haydn, or arrangements of sold-out rock shows. The quartet consists of violinists Benjamin Jacobson and Andrew Bulbrook, violist Jonathan Morschel, and cellist Eric Byers. I spoke with violinist Andrew Bulbrook recently by phone. I began by asking him about the origins of the quartet, Calder's connection with the Carlsbad New Music Festival, and the choice to name the group after sculptor Alexander Calder.
Now you four met at Thornton. Is that right? Okay. Are any of you native Angelenos or?
Ben, the first violinist, is from San Diego.
Okay.
And he studied in L.A. in high school.
Okay. Is that sort of the connection with the Carlsbad New Music Festival? Weren't you guys like the founding quartet for that or something?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we started doing that with our friend Matt McBain in 2003, I think, somewhere around there, maybe, just around 2003. And we were all just finishing school, and we were all friends, and Matt's parents were in San Diego, and Ben's parents were still living in Carlsbad. They've actually sold the house and moved to the Bay Area at this point. But we were kind of going down there a lot on weekends or just to get out of L.A., and had friends down there, and it was a nice time. So then it sort of became a natural thing to try to do a festival down there. So because we were already spending a lot of time in Carlsbad, and then it kind of grew with all of us as our, we stopped being 23-year-olds or 22-year-olds or whatever we were. It was fun to have a place to try your ideas and not have to have another presenter endorse them to do them, because usually programming is a discussion between us and the people putting on the concert. When we do it successfully, it really is a dialogue, and it takes our interests and their interests into account.
You can be a dictator at Carlsbad. You can put out whatever you want.
No, I mean, we work with Matt, so it does that. But when we were first starting out, I felt like, we were getting offers to either play like really classical recitals or nothing else. And so Carlsbad was neat to give us a chance to just, try newer, weirder ideas, newer composers, newer ways of presenting. You want to just play a single movement, or you want to, do something with video, or all these things that the usual music guild, the chamber music, guildy type places, you can't do as much of that there.
Right. No. So you guys have been together, is it 10 years, 12 years you've been playing together?
15 years.
15 years, okay. Wow.
Yeah, same four people. Crazy.
So the name Calder comes from the guy who invented the mobile sculpture, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And why did his name get chosen?
Well, we'd been attracted to his work and his work ethic, and also just how things look easy are the product of a lot of consistent effort over time, to make things that some people might call whimsical or whatever. It is, it's actually really the result of going into the studio every day and working your whole life. So that was, intriguing to us. And then also the mobile is considered one of the more musical forms of sculpture. Sartre wrote a lot about Calder and wrote about how musical and lyrical and the movements of mobiles are. So.
Mm. By all indications, the Calder Quartet appears to be the representative quartet for the 21st century. Young, flexible, open-minded, deeply dedicated to the tradition, and irresistibly drawn to the new. They have held residencies at top schools, like the Colburn Conservatory and Juilliard, and recorded with leading pianists, Gloria Cheng and Anne-Marie McDermott, including, with McDermott, a much-lauded rendition of piano concertos by Mozart, but pared down for piano quintet. They secure coveted spots in global round of music festivals, and at the same time, they are the hot strings heard in the Emmy-winning theme to the stars, Da Vinci's Demons. The Calder is the go-to quartet for leading composers, including Christopher Rouse, Terry Riley, and Thomas Addis. I continued my discussion with violinist Andrew Bulbrook by asking him about working with contemporary composers like Addis, whose Arcadiana is on the program for the February 20th concert in Santa Barbara. I first asked if it was true that the group had recorded the Arcadiana.
Yeah, we have. We're actually going to record it again, and the new quartet and the piano quintet with Tom playing piano. We're going to do another album of all three of those. I think we're going to record it this spring in London. Nice. So that's really exciting. And yeah, right around the time we were founding the Carlsbad Festival with Matt, we also started working with Christopher Rouse at Aspen, the Aspen Music Festival and School. And it was really an amazing process for us at 22 or 23 years old to be working with a living composer with Pulitzer Prizes and Grammys and big artists wanting to premiere his works. But yet that he still, even in that position, he had time to spend with a young quartet that really wanted to like try to master what he'd written. And the pieces weren't being played a lot because they were extremely difficult. So generally after the premiere, they were shelved because it's a big undertaking to take them on.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole experience was really powerful for us, you know, to see how much somebody like that could be moved by your efforts as a performer. You don't have that luxury with Beethoven or any of the guys that aren't with us any longer. But when the composer's alive, it's a really warm and personal thing to take something that they've made. Maybe they made it a few decades ago. Maybe they struggle to remember what it is at times, you know?
Like the Terry Riley pieces that you did from 1960 and 1961.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's just like you're thrilled to meet him, then you play this pieces for him, and then he's got tears in his eyes, and you're still, you know, so excited to meet Terry Riley for the first time, and you're like, wow, this is so crazy, you know, how powerful it can be, and how that process of diligent work can kind of affect another human being.
It's that reciprocal, I mean, because with all the dead composers, it's sort of a one-way river. You just, they've left it, and it's, a lot of times it's iconic, and then you're articulating it, but I could feel removed. Whereas with these commissions, and working with the living composers, it must really influence you as musicians.
Oh yeah, it's been a huge effect, and I think it's motivated us on more traditional repertoire and in terms of finding an authentic voice for it. You know, you read enough music and then meet the writer and you sort of learn the imperfection of written music at a certain point, you know. Like someone will have a tempo marking and you'll play it for them and they'll tell you it's too fast and that's exactly what's written, and they tell you to play it two-thirds as fast and they don't bother to change anything in the music for any future performer. You know?
Right.
And then you start talking about your Beethoven metronome marking. You know, and at a certain point you start to find that often with enough training, your instinct is a good conduit for figuring out the best way to bring the music off.
That's quite a thought. I mean, that the written sheet is sort of this image that's layers removed, and we treat it like gospel and where it should be treated. I suppose you end up treating it like a guide more, and or you try to get between the lines, or you try to find the intuitions that they were meaning that they necessarily couldn't state.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and Haydn, he doesn't write a lot of stuff into the music. It was a good amount of performance practice, but it was sort of assumed, and over the years things get more detailed, and that is really helpful. But yeah, kind of finding the central humanity to everything. And no, I mean, working with people like Chris and kind of having that happen in the same time we were still in school, and then having that go well and broadening the circle of people that were willing to kind of work with us in this way was really a really important part of our development. And the Addis that's on the program is a really, you know, great example of that. You know, we learn the Arcadiana, we start working with Tom on that through the LA Phil maybe 7 years ago now, something like that. And then, you know, it was longer. I think we learned Arcadiana 9 years ago, 2005 or 6 is when we learned it. And then, you know, we learned the piano quintet 4 years later. Really, the pianist Gloria Cheng was so amazing to learn it with us because it's so difficult. And then we put that together, and then, you know, Tom started playing the piano quintet with us, which is an amazing way to, I mean, what better way to understand what's written on a page, right, than to have the composer sitting next to you reading what he wrote. If you want to think about cutting out the sheet music entirely and just going to the idea, you know, that's like kind of the most direct way you could do it.
Right.
And then now the new quartet, 4 quarters, and it's been great that I think Carnegie Hall commissioned it and Emerson gave the premiere, but Tom's asked us to do the first recording, which is a really great honor, and we've been playing that piece for a couple of years now.
Wow.
So, yeah, we're excited about it.
That's fabulous. So what, we might be looking for a CD in 2015 or something?
It's a good question. I wouldn't want to pin a release, but we're going to go in the studio this spring.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would imagine probably sometime in the next year after that. But
Gloria Cheng's Edge of Light was nominated for a Grammy.
Yeah, it was. That was great.
Yeah, and you guys appear on that. And then with Anne-Marie McDermott, you did the chamber versions of the Mozart concertos. What was that like?
Oh, it was great. You know, Annie's really been wonderful to us, and we've been working with her at the Bravo Vale Festival, and we're going to play a few dates with her, I think, next season that are getting worked out. And, she's been a really great influence on us, and especially in the piano quintets like the Brahms and Dvorak, and now these Mozart quintets, which Mozart actually wrote. He in his own hand, transcribed his concertos to this piano quintet version, and it's great, you know, for us to play with somebody like Annie. She's so aware of shaping and phrasing and a certain intuitive
musicality. And we'd been playing with her in different repertoire for a year or two, and then we got together in New York for a week and did the recording. And it was great. I feel like, you know, we don't get to study anymore formally. We're not in school.
Right.
And you sort of look for these chances to always learn and get better. And where do you find them? You get them by playing with other people, right?
Right.
some place, there's something you can take away from that experience. You get it from your colleagues. And working with Annie on this recording and getting to spend just a week in depth with her, I feel like we were able to feed off of that for months after, in all the different facets of what we were doing, kind of striving to find more shape, more direction, make sure things always felt like they were going somewhere.
That's
great.
That's very inspiring. You go around and do a lot of master classes, and you're sort of working firsthand with next generation of string players and kids who want to playing quartets. What do you see? And I guess as a 21st century string quartet, you come from this glorious tradition, and yet the demands on you and the contexts and the of your professional life right now are very different than a quartet 30 years ago. And I wonder what that's like, and what you see, what you see in the new generation that's emerging.
I mean, people play really well. We travel all over the place and hear students at different schools, and I'm struck by how there are great players and great student quartets all over the place. We were just in St. Petersburg, Russia, and heard a really great group. We heard great groups at Oberlin. We hear them everywhere. It is a funny thing, in classical there is this amazing launch mechanism that's created. You think about the string quartets 40 years ago, or like when Emerson's were starting, or even before that, there weren't all these programs to all these graduate programs, all these summer programs, all these like professional development competitions, or all these things. That infrastructure has built up a lot of it since then, and so in some way it generates more quartets than you wonder if it's harder or easier or the same as it used to be, because there wasn't as much support to do it, there wasn't as much development, graduate programs, right? These things didn't exist. But then maybe fewer quartets were coming out, so you guys weren't all neck and neck. Now it really is a glory day of quartets. They're everywhere. They're great. All these people can do it. They can all play, and they're all our friends. They're wonderful people. But it is neat to see so many sort of launched into the touring world. And it just seems like you have to be your own. Where there's so many groups, you have to figure out why you.
Right. I'm sure. The question's late at night. Well, it is, it's inspiring, I think also about broadly all the jazz programs, all over. Mm-hmm. How it's sort of like, I don't know, it's sort of, to me, one of the obvious victories of democracy is the way it's managed to cultivate amongst so many young people really high levels of musical ability. And I guess at the same time it means there's it's less exclusive, so professional opportunities are fewer. But which would you rather have? I mean, it seems more inspiring that so many more people are intimately involved with music as musicians.
Oh, yeah. Overall, I think it's good. And I think just as a performer, you might have to be aware that there's a lot of people getting launched now.
Yeah.
Which is both good, but also, you really have to. And you see it in the presenters. It does seem like they're looking at what's unique, what's different. A lot of them are rethinking whether they present straight classical music at all anymore.
right.
depending on, you know, who they are. You see it maybe in Santa Barbara, where they're doing something with Gabriel Kane.
Yeah, I just talked to him about that, yeah.
Yeah, and us. You know, it's sort of, you can tell that they're looking towards what's a little different, you know, unless, or your Yo-Yo Ma.
Right.
Play, you know, so it's, until you kind of get to the point that you're Yo-Yo, you know.
Yeah.
It's, and Yo-Yo's at this point in his career, maybe exploring more repertoire and ideas than a similar artist would have done 40 years ago. I don't know.
Right.
All that Silk Road stuff would...
Mm-hmm.
Would Janos Starker have done that in his prime? I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
You know, or
the goat rodeo stuff. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it's, but who can argue
no,
with
awesome.
That stuff?
He's so good. I'm not
yeah, yeah.
With it. No.
It's, and they've, and he, you know, he has sort of opened the doors for then people, you know, like the Calder Quartet, because you guys, you, seems to me, I mean, well, I don't think any, right, there's no string quartet in history has been on, has done the late night TV runs like you guys have.
Oh yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Yeah, I know. Yesterday was pretty nuts. We do the soundtrack to the show Da Vinci's Demons on Stars. I don't know if you.
Right, McCreary. You went to school with McCreary.
Yeah. So we were just doing this yesterday, and it was, you know, it got an Emmy for the main title theme.
Oh, nice. Congratulations.
Yeah, and that's like the first thing we ever recorded with Bear the first day. It was mental. So now Stars is like super pumped, and so they were there like in full force yesterday. It was wild. Like LA Times was there. They're like filming Stars special features. We're doing interviews with them for all this stuff, and then David S. Goyer, the producer's on the ground. I mean, it was just like, it's really interesting. But it, you know, the cool thing is it actually stems from the exact same way we work with all our composers. I mean, it's like the exact same process of you know, really trying to make it awesome, you know, really trying to get it and to be willing to go there for somebody else, you know. And it's exciting to start seeing that it, you know, it's neat how it can get recognition in different ways, either with bands, like you're saying, on like TV, or in this other context of film and TV music. It's fun.
There's a lot of great film music being written. You do wonder if, you know, is it, are the, you know, rather than, I mean, it's still art music, I guess you can, in a way, but it's connected with the context of film, and you wonder if in the future, you know, they'll be looking back at the great composers as the film composers. No.
Yeah, I there's so many good composers, and what I realize more and more is a lot of them are, you have to work in multiple fields. You know, it's sort of, the assumption is a composer works in academia. But if for some reason that's not for you, you know, you have to come up with some other thing, either as a composer performer, writing, you know, commercial music, or many bands, most of the bands that are indie have a trained composer in them, you know, or someone with enough background to be called that, whether they went to school for it or not. So, and then a lot of them are writing on a wide spectrum. You know, they might write a concert piece, and they're writing, you know, arrangements for their band, and then they're writing a film score. I mean, this, you see this all the time. And, yeah, sort of the assumption that to be good, one needs to be in the academic system. I think that's breaking down.